Welcome to Open Book on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Tony Taccone, who is the author of a play, Ghostlight, now playing at Berkeley Rep in Berkeley. Tony Taccone is also the author of another play, which played earlier this year, Rita Moreno, Life Without Makeup. He's the artistic director of Berkeley Rep Theater Company in Berkeley. This play is about Jonathan Moscone, son of George Moscone, the assassinated mayor of San Francisco, and looks through his eyes at coming to terms with his father's assassination. It's a curious project because it began as a collaboration between Tony and John Moscone, and in the end, Tony wrote the script for the play and John directed it. That means that he's directing an actor playing himself who was written by you.
An odd Rubik's Cube there.
Let's go back and talk a little bit about this play, and then I want to ask you a little bit about the creation at Berkeley Rep in particular.
Sure.
And how you're bringing it to fruition in its what's now its second incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, according to what I read in your Berkeley Rep magazine, you and John were talking at a bar at some point, but in point of fact, in a separate piece inside the magazine, John Moscone had been thinking about this for a long time and kind of approached you. So how did that really work?
Those are both accurate statements. John, I think, has been simmering probably for about 33 years or so on his desire, if not responsibility to talk about his dad. I've known John for a really long time. He's never wanted to talk about his dad. He was 14 when his father was killed, and there was a deep trauma there which sort of plunged him into a period of intense and unrelenting silence, both personally and, I think, politically. So I think that for him, this represents a bit of a coming out party. He knew that the film Milk was being made, and I think that was a spur for him. He was on the set for the movie. He was invited to come to the set for the movie. He was deeply disappointed when the movie came out, which was after we started working on the play about the portrayal of his dad. So there were a lot of mitigating factors that went into his desire to call me up and say, hey, can we meet? I want to talk to you about something. And so we did meet in a bar, Revival, actually, what it used to be called downtown, which is right on the corner of Addison and Shattuck, and we went over there, and he sprung this idea on me that he wanted to do not a docudrama, not anything realistic. He wanted to do a kind of a dreamy fathers and sons play. He started telling me some anecdotes from his life about that story, and they floored me. But I have to say, at that time, it was just two artists talking. There was no designation who would write, who would direct. He just proposed that we make a piece, and I tell you, I walked out of that bar, and I thought, I was really moved and touched, but thought there's no way. I don't think we're going to do anything. It's just, it's too far-fetched. It's too loose. But in fact, you know, here we are 2.5 years later, and, you know, I'm talking to you on the verge of opening night. So something happened.
By that point, he had not contacted, or he had contacted Oregon Shakespeare Festival, or there was nothing.
Bill Rauch, who's the artistic director of Oregon Shakespeare Festival, wonderful organization, many of you out there hearing this will have been there and know it well. Bill had started this project called the American Revolution Project, which was basically to commission writers and artists to create pieces based on specific periods of American history. John heard about it, sent him a little email, said, hey, Bill, I've got this idea to do something related in a personal way about my father, and Bill was all over it. Got back to him right away and said, I'm interested. It sounds really intriguing. And John was like, okay, let me go rustle up some help. And so that's where I came in.
Was he in charge of Cal Shakes at the time or not?
Oh, yeah. John's been there for quite a while now. He was safely ensconced there in the throes of his season.
So he approaches you. You sit there and talk. And you walk out. And you're going, sounds fascinating, but this is just completely way past what
Well, first of all, you know, I said to him at one point jokingly, "See, what are we going to do, improv with the actors about, you know, like assassination?" I mean, aside from the desire to make something, we had no plan, like zero. And so it seemed far-fetched, so I never really thought anything would happen. But it quickly turned into something else because Bill called us up. Bill Rauch called us up and said, I want to offer you guys a commission. And I was like, are you kidding? Are you out of your mind? I mean, you know, who's going to do, you know, who's going to write this thing? He said, oh, you guys will figure something out. And so after that, I got worried. So I started calling John up and said, we got to meet about it. We got to talk about this. And so he started coming over to my house, and I just started asking him questions. And that led to a period of about 6 months where he'd come over to my house, you know, maybe once every couple of weeks, and I'd ask him questions, everything related from what it was like that day that his father was killed all the way to, you know, what happened afterwards, what life is like now, his dream life, all kinds. And then I started to get interested in separate topics because the piece is a piece of fiction. It's based in his experience, but the only way that I think John can actually direct this play and direct the character of John in the play is because it's not him. I mean, people think it's him, but it's not. I was not trying to write a biography. And I think that's the only reason why. I think the two of us were freed, imaginatively freed, to be able to tell a story of our own invention.
In the Berkeley Rep magazine, you talk about how at one point he just laid down and you were sitting there with your laptop typing away.
In hindsight, I think they did turn into sort of pseudo-therapy sessions. I mean, not that I was ever his therapist, of course, but just the sort of silhouette of one guy on one couch, the other guy with a laptop. And John has said on a couple of occasions that, you know, as the conversations would go on, he would start to, like, lean down on the couch to the point where he was, like, grabbing his head and kind of, like, holding onto the upholstery. It did have, though, the feeling of sort of deep meditative conversations in which I was probing him to go back into his memory and to jam and to free associate in some ways about what the experience was like emotionally and then what the experience was like cognitively or, you know, in terms of his conscious life. I'd write down everything from a phrase that I thought was really insightful, or I'd certainly write out the snippets of a story, certain dreams. I certainly didn't write everything. And there was no recorder. I didn't use a tape recorder. I didn't want to do that because they weren't transcriptions. They were meant to be notes towards potentially dramatic events. That's what I was trying to get. I was trying to get at what in this might translate onto the stage.
So we have a situation where you have the son of the assassinated mayor, who also is involved in very heavily involved in theater. He's sitting there. He's talking to you. Were you talking to him about the directions that the play would go, or were you just talking about
his
memories?
No, we were just talking about his memories and life experience and his family. And then we talked about the culture. Obviously, I'm a person who believes in history as a prism for understanding what it is that we're experiencing and who we are. And so I started to place the thing into the larger context of history. Now, you have to understand, I had done a play called Execution of Justice years and years before, which was a docudrama about this very event. So I didn't have to spend a lot of time talking about the facts of that. What we really spent time with was sort of pursuing the heart, what I would call the heart of the experience, through a very subjective lens of somebody's psychological experience.
I remember the day.
Right. Mind-boggling.
Absolutely.
Surreal. Mind-boggling. And people forget, you know, it occurred just a week after Jonestown. And so we were all carrying the imagined movie in our heads of Jonestown happening, you know, which was horrific and unbelievable and incomprehensible and a betrayal of San Francisco's mythology about itself in so many ways. And then to have this happen, it felt like literally the world was coming apart.
Then within a very short time, I noticed that here we had the assassination of a mayor and a supervisor, and yet the supervisor, who was a gay icon,
right,
but granted he was a supervisor, suddenly became the person who was assassinated, and the mayor became an asterisk.
Well,
I saw that.
Yeah, I think that happened over time. I think that when the event happened itself, there was much more of a shared sensibility of loss. But obviously, history selects what it wants to select. And obviously, the importance of Harvey historically became increasingly enhanced, and I think for the right reasons. I mean, I think people needed the idea of Harvey because the most amazing thing about him was his challenge to people to come out, just come out. And he was brazen about it. It's why he thought he would die, because of his boldness of his assertions and the consistency of his exhortations. And so with the passing of each year, Harvey's growth as an icon was exponential, and unfortunately to the detriment of the legacy of George Moscone.
which you restore briefly in a passage in the play where we find out it was George Moscone who made consensual sex between men legal in the state of California.
Well, he did that with the help of some of his mates in the assembly, but he definitely was one of the most forthright advocates. And I think for George, the issue was not so much gay rights, but civil rights. He championed civil rights. I mean, he cut his teeth riding the buses in the South in the 50s and early 60s. He was a kind of liberal of the first order, and he was instrumental, I would say, in forming an alliance with Harvey that allowed him to be elected.
The thing that I remember most about San Francisco between when I first got here, which was in late 75, and what happened a year later after Moscone was elected, the town changed profoundly almost overnight, and you could feel it. By 78, within 2 years, it was a completely different city.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, George's inaugural celebration was evidently, from what I can gather, a completely different event than what had been in the past. He invited every kind of group that had formerly not been invited. And so the sense of inclusion and diversification and real collaborative alliances with different groups of people was made palpable by George. You know, he basically changed the character of City Hall.
Tony Taccone, getting back to Ghostlight, you've got all of this information in your head. You have this play that you worked on, mm-hmm. which is the history, the docudrama of the events. You have this man in front of you on the couch.
Right.
who's telling you about how it affected him, which is more profoundly, and even what we're talking about, the kind of loss of Moscone in history is going to affect him too,
right.
because he's the son.
Right.
You've got all of that. At what point did you finally put together, or did John put together, the idea that the way to make this work was to have John, the character, be dealing with the ghost in Hamlet?
That was me. I've been obsessed with Hamlet for a long time, and I was actually on the road with another show with my little pile of notes in my laptop, and it suddenly came to me this idea of a three-part story with three different narrative lines. One, you know, with the boy, the 14-year-old boy who was sort of guarding his father's coffin and who, while he couldn't emotionally connect to the loss of father, he still felt obligated and bad to sort of leave his father. So that's one story. The ghost in Hamlet is a very difficult character to figure out. How you do the ghost in Hamlet, you know, can actually make or break a show. And I thought, well, he's got to be obsessing about the ghost in Hamlet. That felt to me like a really ripe and appropriate theatrical event that would inform the Moscone story as well. It's not meant to be the exact story. It's just meant to be a parallel story. And then the last story would be what was happening in his unconscious life, which becomes made manifest and then crashes into his conscious life. And then I had to figure out how to meld all three stories and have them all resolve at the end. No, I put that on myself, I have to say.
The third story concerns a fantasy that he has, but he's been chatting online with a guy and he's going to meet the guy.
It's absolutely a fantasy, yeah. It's a fantasy of who this guy might be.
And then you bring in another character who confronts the fantasy.
Right, right.
So suddenly you brought in a completely different idea, which is the idea of internet dating.
Uh-huh.
And did that come out of your conversations with John then?
Well, John has a very curious dating history, which I won't go into right now. But obviously, clearly, the internet as a dating device is something that people really get. It's becoming more and more popular. But what intrigued me was the idea of a guy distracting himself from reality, and the easiest way to do that was to go online. Here's a guy who has a big issue with silence. He has a big issue with being quiet with himself, is not at peace. And in order to distract himself, this is the character I'm talking about, you know, like in the play, he uses the internet. He uses this online conversation he's having with this guy who calls himself Loverboy, that's his internet name, as a way to channel his desire, like his need for romance, his need for intimacy. Of course, the great irony there is that you're not talking to a real person. And so I thought that there would be some comedy in there and some irony, and I hope that there certainly is.
Well, it struck me that it hit a completely different nerve, which is the relationship of a real person to their online persona
right.
and the interaction. Suddenly there's a huge disconnect, and what it seemed to me was that if you're looking for metaphors here, and this may be not right. not necessarily something you intended, but what we're seeing throughout the play in the dream sequences, in the memory mm-hmm. slash dream sequences, and in this, it's all about disconnect.
Uh-huh. That's very apt. I mean, one of the things I was trying to do is that one of the sensations John actually did talk to me a lot about was this feeling of being alone. When he's a 14-year-old boy, you see him alone. The first picture of the play is of a boy alone on stage and surrounded by noise and pictures. And the question of how to do that as an adult, well, you're surrounded by people, but you're not letting them in. You still have this barrier between you and them. Even with his closest friends, he refuses to expose himself in any kind of vulnerable way. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, the idea of this guy carrying the aloneness of his childhood fully into the aloneness of his adult world was one of the major issues I was exploring.
I noticed something else, and again, this may not have been deliberate, but in Act One, a lot of the sequences occur with the character of John off stage. In Act Two, he's on stage observing some of these, which means it could be that you're trying for some kind of individuation occurring?
Yes. I mean, as the play moves forward in time, first of all, he no longer has the ability. He basically has a bit of a breakdown. Towards the end of Act One, his anxiety increases all throughout the act, and the mechanisms that he has, the armor that he has to keep himself away from the demons and the ghosts that are haunting him, breaks down. And he literally has a bit of a seizure or, you know, some arrhythmia. And the act ends with him looking for the first time into the face of one of the ghosts, his most intense avenging angel. From that point on, he has to now confront in a more conscious way what is actually going on. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. He starts to actually get closer and closer and closer to the actual reality that's causing his neurosis and, in some instances, his illness. He has to slay his demons, you know, literally. And at the very end of the play, he does achieve some healing. But one of the things I wanted to get at, though, Richard, is that I wanted to get away from this easy sense of closure, because I don't think that change works that way. I don't think that our psychology works that way. I think we heal in small increments, and we carry our past. So at the very end of the play, it's not like he's, like, resolved. It's that he's learned that he's carrying something that has the possibility of being dangerous and powerful. And if he doesn't honor it and respect it and embrace it, then he's going to be suffering for it. And so I think that he does learn that. But at the very end of the play, he isn't a different person. He's just a guy who's more aware in his conscious life that he has to pay more respect.
Tony Tocconi, you finished the play, that first draft. How close was that to what people are seeing at Berkeley Rep?
It's pretty far away from that. The play has gone through a huge metamorphosis. The one thing I will say, which though hasn't changed that much, is the structure. The structure of the play came to me very early and felt very strong, felt firm enough that I could continue to rework the internal guts of the scenes, but the way it flowed and where each scene had to happen and what had to happen in the scenes, I thought was strong enough to withstand the sort of formidable criticisms of the army of dramaturgs that came to work on it with us. But it has changed. Hopefully it's gotten deeper and sharper and more insightful.
There's a character of his best friend who he bounces a lot of ideas off. Was she there from the start?
Yes, but in the very, very first incarnation, they had a different psychological relationship. I think my first take on it was that they may have been lovers at one point, and there was a whole thing about, you know, that, and then he became gay, and that seemed really unhelpful. He just got rid of it.
And then it eventually gets to Oregon, which was when?
July 2nd it opened there.
Okay, after it opened, I eventually got a script. I was looking through it to see what kind of changes there were, and I noticed the biggest changes that I saw. One was that there's very little in the way of direction in the script. There's some, but not a whole lot. The biggest change I saw is that John, the character, confronts individual audience members, making them really uncomfortable in what we see That's not in the script.
That came out of the performance. It was always meant because he's performing the monologues to the audience. That's in there. But Chris Moore, who's brilliant in the lead role, the guy is absolutely astonishing. I mean, he's an amazing actor. He took it to the next level. He started playing with the audience. It's indicated in the script that he should identify people in the audience, but the way he is doing it is really fun. And he's having such mischievous fun with them. What's great about it is that it just sort of blows the play open a little bit. He identifies certain people in his quote-unquote acting class as characters in Hamlet. And so the audience is not required to say anything, but he certainly calls out some people for being bad actors.
Now, he also throws things at the audience to answer, and a couple of people do.
Well, what's in the script was like, here the actor has the license to do what he wants to do. So that's in there. I mean, I wanted that. I wanted the fourth wall to be shattered. One scene ends, which has, like, ghosts and mysteries in it, and another scene starts with the actor saying, how many people thought that was true? How many people, like, bought into that last scene? Raise your hand. I mean, that's in the script. So that there's obviously, I'm obviously trying to not be pretentious about the sort of what I call the ooga booga factor.
There's also a mention of two shows, Spider-Man and Book of Mormon. That puts that play in a particular time. Is that open to change down the road then?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, I think that the play is meant to be happening now. We've changed the titles, you know, from Book of Mormon to other plays that we thought would be. At one point, it was Phantom of the Opera. I just like the idea that the Dalai Lama is dreaming about, you know, trying to get free house seats to a Broadway show. I just thought that's really funny.
And this mention of Quentin Kopp,
which we didn't have in Oregon. I've changed some of the theatrical references as well. I mean, in here, the Christmas Carol story that's told is referred to as, you know, to ACT just because they do Christmas Carol every single year. And, you know, if it's done in other places, I would expect that those references all, you know, to change to whatever theater is appropriate.
That, of course, got a big laugh from the audience. Yeah. And I don't think Kari Perloff would be upset about it.
No, you can't. In fact, it's a gesture of homage to Kari having to do that show every year.
Tony Taccone, okay, you've got the play, you've done that, and now John goes to direct it. Now, you're a director, basically.
Yep.
The other play that you wrote, Life Without Makeup, with Rita Moreno, you didn't direct that.
I didn't. No, I made a pact with myself that I wouldn't direct anything I wrote.
How did that feel this time compared to the other time? Was it fine both times? Did you have any trepidation?
I think Rita's was a little harder because the director was a guy who really wasn't from our world in some ways. He was more like a cabaret guy, and he knew that world really well. He's brilliant with music, just really, really great. And I didn't know anything about that, but I think he was a little bit less familiar with the regional theater scene. This felt basically really good. I mean, John, after we got over the hump of the oddness of, like, you're really going to direct this play, which just seemed very odd. I mean, when he said to me, well, I guess if you're going to write, because I became clear that I was writing the play. I literally said to John, I said, you know, John, it appears that I'm writing the play. And he said, I guess you are. And that was a big moment for us. We were like a year in, you know, before that happened. And then he said, well, I guess I would be the director. And I said, well, I guess you would be. So we had a workshop. We already had one workshop with just me and the actors up at Ashland. But our second workshop, he was the director. And I think that was in some ways a test for all of us to see if that would work. Once the actors got over feeling intimidated, they were totally into it, and he was great at it. And I think he's done a wonderful job.
Well, the actor who plays John, from what I'm reading here, I have never met John, does a pretty good impression of John.
You know, people say that, and I don't – there are little hints of John's behavior, but he's not the same physical type. He's not the same vocal type. I mean, people just – I think that's a testament, to be honest with you. I think it's a testament to people's projection of John onto the character, onto Chris. I wasn't trying to write John in a biographical way. I wasn't trying to capture how he talked. In fact, I think the character talks a lot more like me than he does him. So I don't get that. But you know what? I'm not going to try to get it.
Did you have any trouble writing any of the gay material?
Very early on, I thought to myself, wait a minute. You're going to do this? You're going to try to bite off writing from a perspective that is not who you are? And I just, you know, I had a little 2-minute conversation with myself, and I said, Tony, they're people. It's just human beings. And go there. And I did. And so after that, I never looked back.
Not long ago, I interviewed Stephen Sondheim, and I asked him why he likes to collaborate. And he said, because I like to argue with people. Why do you like to collaborate?
I like to win the arguments. I think really, in a healthy situation, simply put, the work gets better. Your ideas get richer. I think it was very good decision on my part to not direct my own work, because I feel like when I've seen that happen before, at some point the writer has got to shut down and the director has to take over. And I wanted to be able to sit back as long as possible just as the writer and say, that line doesn't work. I want to change that, that, and that, and not have to worry about fixing my own mistakes or covering them up. I wanted to expose myself fully to them. And I have to say, one of the great joys, there is terror. I have to say, there's terror, because you look at some stuff and you go, are you kidding me? That's not what was written, or that's not how I heard it, or that. But once you let go of that, when you can, the amazing ideas other people have that just enliven what you've written is really rewarding.
Well, when you're a director and you're the artistic director, is that a similar detachment that you have to take, or do you have somebody else, like for the past few years, say Les Waters, sitting there kind of acting as sort of pseudo-artistic director?
I think it is tricky. It definitely is tricky, because I definitely think you want to protect yourself as an artist a little bit more. And I have to say, being a writer, you're more vulnerable than, I'm sorry, but anybody else involved in the process. You're the last bucket in the fire brigade. You know, there's nobody else to blame. You know, when you're a director and actor, you're essentially an interpretive artist. When you're the writer, you are the seminal creative element. You know, it's personal. It's personal in a way that it's not as much with the other jobs. And not that they aren't jobs that don't tax people and aren't really challenging, and you don't have to, you know, dig into your unconscious. But as a writer, you have to dig farther.
And how do you feel? I mean, I guess for you as the writer, if John makes a decision, a part of you is going, okay, this is John's story, but what about another director?
I don't think about that. I don't think that this is John's story, ever. It's my story. It's my story, too. There's as much about my dad in there as there is, about his dad. So I don't feel that. I do feel, though, as a director, I feel like, wait a minute, are you going to interpret that way? I mean, look, a script is like a piece of music. It's like a score. And you want people to sing it right. You want people to sing it the way you wrote it. Now, some people will sing parts of it in a way that you didn't imagine that are better. And some people are singing parts of it in a way that you don't think works. And so you spend time with the director, John, you know, in this case. Also, the good thing is we are directors, and so we do have the same language to be able to talk about stuff. And I think we've done a very good job of not confusing the cast. So whatever issues we have, we talk about them away from the cast.
And then he just presents them to the cast.
Yes.
I saw you there Saturday night watching the audience and watching the stage. What were you looking for? What were you seeing?
Well, it was the second preview, so it was still at that formative stage where the actors are discovering the house, how the house plays. What that means is how the actual space plays for the actors, where they have to throw their focus. How big do they have to be? How small can they be? I was, of course, looking for, like, where the laughs, making sure that the laughs, you know, were happening, what lines needed to be tweaked to get the biggest responses, or the opposite, where would, you know, do we not want to laugh? We had the great luxury of playing the play for 4 months up in Ashland, so we know a lot about that. And in some ways, you're kind of comparing the responses. But with a text, you can pretty much tell this stuff lands here, that stuff lands over there. I have been particularly focused on the play swings wildly in its tone. It goes from really serious, you know, fraught scenes to funny scenes. And I want the audience to feel really free to experience the widest possible spectrum of thoughts and feelings while they're watching the play. So after the first scene, with the boy, which is kind of freaky and scary, where, you know, he's being sort of asked questions by an unseen shrink about his experience, and then this weird guy shows up and they run off. It's really important for me that the next series of jokes lands, because I don't want the audience to feel intimidated by the subject matter.
Well, also a little bit lost, and you bring them right back.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. By the third show, with each show, you start to see an increasing level of confidence on the part of the cast. And also just, you know, there's been changes, you know, and so there's stuff like that that they have to get used to.
Well, now in the past year, you've written two plays. Are you going to do more playwriting now?
Yeah.
Have you started the process with other pieces then?
Yeah, I have.
How many?
Two. But I don't know if they'll be done. But I have started the process, and it takes a while to get the treadmill going.
I think in an earlier interview I asked you about whether you'd like to direct film, but let me ask you, would you like to write screenplays?
You know, my eldest son writes screenplays, and he does it really, really well. And while I could say on one hand, yeah, sure, why not? On the other hand, it's a different medium, and you have to respect that. It's a largely visual medium, and so my plays are driven by language. They're just driven by words. I love words, and it's one of the reasons I actually took to this form, I think, in a relatively aggressive way. I think it would be a very different and humbling experience for me to just then switch gears. I think I'm arrogant enough to think that I might be able to give it a whirl, but I'm not stupid enough to think that, you know, it wouldn't be really hard, and I don't know if I have the time for it.
Well, that brought up another question, which is when you were actually creating the piece with the director, your role as the playwright in terms of the set design, the lighting, and all of that. Obviously, the director's going to do the blocking, right. But how involved are you at that end of the collaborative process? And was it similar to the way when you've worked with writers?
It depends which writer. Basically, what John did was when they got to a stage with the set where they had something that they liked, they showed me. I wasn't involved with early conversations. I didn't want to be, you know. Plus, the designers he has are spectacular. I mean, come on. These guys know what they're doing. I mean, I'm not going to micromanage this stuff. I mean, they're great. So my job is to stay the hell out. But I obviously did want to see, and John wanted me to see, you know, when they had something which they liked to show me, when there was still time to get into a conversation about it. And right away I could see that they were onto something good, and then I had notes about that. I just gave them some feedback, and it morphed. It morphed into something, you know, that I thought was really good.
A couple of quick questions, Tony Taccone, about Berkeley Rep. One that came up from a friend of mine, which is that she couldn't afford to see the show. She wanted to become an usher. All she had to do was call up, and then she gets to see it in the third tier or whatever. How does that work?
Ushers, you have to call the theater. I don't know if you can do it on the website. I'm sure the information is on the website. But you get in a list. A lot of people do it. I think you're assigned a night. And you have to come, I think, an hour before the curtain. And you got to dress and you have to wear something white on top and black slacks or something on your legs, and you get a little orientation from the house manager. In terms of the seating, you get the best available seat after the audience is already in their seats, so ushers can sit anywhere from the first row to the last row. It's pretty straight up stuff. I mean, you don't have to speak Swedish, and you don't have to know how to translate arcane texts. You know, you just have to be, you know, accommodating. I think there's an orientation about, you know, how the seats are numbered, and I think there's a real orientation about treating patrons. You know, I mean, people want to be treated with civility and efficiency and respect and some care. And also, you know, there's people with special needs, you know, whether it's people who are infirm or people who can't hear, you know, as well. So there's all kinds of ways to deal with that.
Les Waters has left.
He has.
That means that there's an opening at Berkeley Rep?
No. I mean, I'm going to take a few years to actually replace the job full time, because I want to use the time to actually have a lot of other people come in and share with us their perspective. The country is filled with so many great directors in every stage of their careers, and so I'm really excited about using the opportunity to bring in some new folks.
Ghost Life plays through February 19th. Would there be any chance of an extension?
For 1 week, there's a possibility, because the cast is largely from Ashland, and they can stay for one more week, and then they have to go back.
And the next play after that?
Is A Doctor in Spite of Himself, Molière. This is a production that comes to us from Yale Rep, actually, starring Steve Epp, who many of our audience members have seen. He was the principal actor for Theatre de la Jeune Lune for many years. So he was the lead role in The Miser. Steve is a phenomenal comic actor. So he's got the lead in this, and I've seen the script and worked with him, and I think it's going to be spectacular.
Tony Taccone, in looking back on Ghostlight, how do you feel overall about doing a project of this kind of surreal nature?
It has surreal elements, but I think the story is grounded in reality and in psychology in a way that anybody can understand. It's very ambitious. There's no question that the kind of narrative layering that I have, the fact that I've literally kept the audience slightly unaware of all of the factors all the way through like the middle of Act One is thorny. Because, I mean, the audience has to decide that they're going to stay with it. But hopefully it's funny enough and dramatic enough and arresting enough that it holds. I think for people, though, who make the right choice, it has the potential to be really rewarding in a number of ways. And I'm really, really proud of that. It was inspired in many ways by Angels in America, because Tony Kushner is somebody whose work, I think, is fantastically ambitious. But it's respectful, because it starts out with the premise that you can get it. Everyone is really smart, and you can get it. And the faults, if they don't get it, are obviously mine. But I do think that there is a kind of thrill to when I've sat in those audiences with his work and been thrilled by this guy's, you know, willingness to kind of make me, like, think a little bit and to work a little bit. But the idea that the rewards are that much greater was certainly inspirational. So I don't mean to sound like I'm Tony Kushner, because I'm not, but I do feel that I was inspired by his work.
You've been listening to an interview with Tony Taccone, who is the author of Ghostlight, a play at Berkeley Rep in Berkeley through February 19th. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.